to the Nashville Story. I'm Stuart Deming.
And I'm Aaron Pennington. It is one of our favorite days on the Nashville Story. It is History Day. And on the program, we have Jim Lewis, the Chief of Interpretation, Education, and Cultural Resource Management at Stones River National Battlefield.
The Battle of Stones River happened way back in the day, 158 years ago, give or take. And this happened on December 31st of 1862 and finished in January 2nd of 1862.
So we are talking with Jim Lewis about what happened many years ago on these exact dates. So it may feel like you are actually there on the battlefield. Jim is an incredible guest. We are honored to have him on the program. We hope you enjoy this history episode of The National Story with Jim Lewis.
We are currently in Murfreesboro, Tennessee at the National Park that's found down here, the Battle of Stones River. And we are with Jim Lewis. What is your role here at the Battle of Stones River National Park?
I'm the Chief of Interpretation here at the battlefield.
So give us a day-to-day type thing for your job description.
Well, under normal conditions, my job is to manage the staff that share the stories of the Battle of Stones River with folks, starting with our visitor center operation, you know, which is manned by both paid staff and quite a few volunteers. We live or die by our volunteers here at the battlefield, but also planning things like, you know, media that we have, exhibits, social media, website, you know, all the different ways we can communicate the resources and story of the battle to folks.
What has that been like in 2020, trying to communicate in different ways?
It's been challenging for sure. I mean, we've, for the most part, we haven't done much of what a lot of people think of when they think of a park visit, which is a talk or a tour or something with a ranger wearing a flat hat out on the battlefield. We haven't been able to do that much, nor have we, you know, had the chance to, you know, to really safely do things like our living history demonstrations and whatnot, which are, you know, often, you know, big crowd pleasers. But it has helped us focus on, you know, finding those new ways. In fact, I would say right now our web presence is as good as it's ever been. We've been talking for years about having a virtual tour, but never really had the time to do it because we were so busy doing stuff here on the ground. Well, my team didn't have to do that stuff anymore, so we now have a virtual tour. We now have videos being produced to go with that and have started doing, you know, outreaches through Zoom and stuff like that with schools and stuff. So it has been a way for us to sort of spread our wings and, you know, try to find new ways to get the story out for sure. I mean, heck, we were in the middle of our anniversary, and I mean, we're doing all of our commemoration this year via our social media.
Wow.
I've been following you guys on Instagram, and you guys have been posting quite a bit the last week. Because, you
know, wait till tomorrow.
Yeah.
What our focus is this year is we've gone to the letters and the diaries of the soldiers, and every day you're going to get some snippet from those letters and diaries and experience the Battle of Stones River, actually the entire campaign. We started on the 26th of December. We will end on January 5th, which is the day the Union Army finally moved into Murfreesboro and called it a day. And every one of those days will feature perspectives from soldiers, so you literally get it straight from the horse's mouth, which is, I think, the best way to do it anyway.
I think one of the interesting questions before we get into the battle and the context and everything is more about, you know, over the past year, have you seen a significant thirst for more outdoor activities?
Oh, absolutely. It's funny. Once we got back to having our visitor center partially open, you know, the way it is still currently, we're open Fridays through Mondays, and then the restrooms are open and the park is open the other 3 days, but the smaller staff that we have working with the public takes their days off on those days. But what we've noticed is we're not doing quite as well in visitation as we count them coming into the visitor center, which is kind of your history visitors.
You're right, yeah.
But our counts at the gate that count, you know, traffic coming in and out of the park are actually up about 20% from what they were last year.
Oh, that's
fantastic. With about a month and a half of the park being completely closed.
Oh, wow.
you know, from, you know, late March into the end of April, when we sort of followed suit with Tennessee State Parks and kind of closed our parks. So we lost that, and we're still up because of
that's
that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Do you guys see yourself as a significant role in the Murfreesboro area in providing outdoor recreation, green space, and
oh, absolutely,
like that?
Yeah, we are. I mean, you know, we were chatting about this before we got started. I mean, Murfreesboro is a growing city. The whole Nashville area is growing, so green space is becoming more and more something that is of a, you know, need for people, and particularly this, you know, with this year and COVID, and you know, outdoors being really your safest place to be.
Yeah,
we're seeing that a lot. And and the great thing is Murfreesboro has a really excellent park system as well. A lot of other options around, so we don't have to be the only game in town. Like our friends down in Georgia in Kennesaw, I mean, they're like the only piece of green space within 30 miles outside of, you know, of, you know, Atlanta,
wow,
just about, or in that Marietta area, and they're overwhelmed.
Yeah, wow.
But we have green, you know, our city has a greenway system that's several miles long, several larger parks with trail systems.
Get some waterfalls close by.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we work very well with them to kind of spread out that recreational need. Yeah.
Do you think that recreation is here because of MTSU? And
some
of
it, I mean, most of it, I think, though, is just driven by, I mean, the city is bigger, you know, and MTSU is certainly one of the drivers of that. I would say, though, that we probably see more folks that are older than your MTSU students. So I don't, you know, certainly some of them do come out here, and we're happy to see that. But I think it's just the overall growth of the area and people wanting, you know, a nice, safe place. And a lot of our folks tell us, I mean, yeah, they like, you know, it's a beautiful park setting, but they also like the fact that they're jogging, walking, you know, biking, and can absorb some of that history at the same time. So we can offer, you know, a little bit more maybe than just your regular plain old park.
Right, exactly.
Well, so on the podcast, we don't talk about Murfreesboro at all. I don't think we've really talked about Murfreesboro. The only time we've talked about Murfreesboro in 400 and some episodes is this was the capital seat of Tennessee two different times. And can you talk a little bit about the history of Murfreesboro just in general?
Well, Murfreesboro is named for a colonel in the Continental Army who got a land grant out here by the name of Murfree. And he and others moved out to this area after the Revolutionary War. Now, you're getting way outside my normal history.
And that's the same thing that happened in Nashville's land
grants. You're talking about a different war.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. Murfreesboro ultimately did become a burgeoning little town. And we sit kind of in an area, you know, right in the middle of Tennessee. And in fact, the marker for the geographic center of the state is just outside the MTSU campus.
Oh, that's cool.
And Murfreesboro over time developed where it kind of sat at the crux of a number of roads going to, you know, Nashville and McMinnville and Manchester and Shelbyville and Lebanon. And so kind of sitting on a spiderweb of roads, which is one of the reasons probably you end up having a battle here in the Civil War. So it begins to, you know, rise some in prominence. And, yeah, ultimately it will serve as the capital of the state for a time. Although a lot of people point at our courthouse, which is a pre-Civil War courthouse, and say that was the capital. But that actually wasn't, because the courthouse wasn't big enough for the legislature to meet in. So they actually met in the First Presbyterian Church.
Yeah.
And that's in downtown Murfreesboro, correct?
It was. The church that they met in no longer exists. That was actually destroyed following the Battle of Stones River. The Union Army tore it down.
Wow.
And then they built another building. That one was actually destroyed by a tornado.
Oh, no.
And their third incarnation, though, sits just outside the town square.
Sounds like the story of New Orleans right there.
It also sounds like the First Presbyterian Church in downtown Nashville. Have you seen that building?
Yes.
It's all themed as an Egyptian-type place on the inside, but it burnt down twice. It was destroyed by another, like... I think it was destroyed by a bombing as well at one point. Yeah, it has a crazy history. So how long has this park actually been a national park?
We were established as a national military park in March of 1927. At that time, we were under the War Department. We would become part of the National Park Service like many of the other battlefields and other types of national monuments in 1933 when the FDR would basically transfer all these places that were held by either the War Department or other departments to this relatively new agency. You know, the Park Service was only created in 1916. Wow. So, I mean, you know, but that moment is actually when the National Park Service becomes a coast-to-coast, north-to-south agency, because prior to that, most of the parks were west of the Mississippi, you know, the ones we think of, Yellowstone, Yosemite, right. Grand Canyon.
All the ones that Theodore Roosevelt
yeah, wanted. That was the Park Service. Well, Yosemite now, that has a Civil War connection. The landmass that would become the core of Yosemite National Park was actually set aside as a federal reservation to be run by the state of California by President Abraham Lincoln in 1864.
Wow. Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, and it doesn't become a national park until sometime later, so it's not the, quote, first national park, but I always like to point out that President Lincoln actually had something to do with us as well.
Wow, very interesting. So I think we're sitting at a very timely date right now, and obviously, you know, this is airing, everybody's hearing this probably January 2nd of 2021, but This timeline that we're in right now is a very historic one. So what is the historic aspect of these dates that we're sitting on right now?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, we're talking now, you know, a few days before January 2nd, but, you know, today is December 30th, and that is what we refer to as the eve of battle. The Union Army of the Cumberland had left Nashville the day after Christmas, 1862, with orders to engage the Confederate Army of Tennessee that was here in Murfreesboro.
Was this led by General Hood at this time or no?
No, Hood will take over later in 1864. This is Braxton Bragg on the Confederate side and General William S. Rosecrans, who just recently taken command on the Union.
This general?
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, because Bragg was originally from North Carolina.
Okay, that makes sense.
And that's the bases that are named after Confederate generals. Generally, that's their home state or the state that they spent most of their time. You know, so that's why Fort Lee is in Virginia. And Fort Hood, he was from Texas. That's where that comes from.
Gotcha.
But anyway, you know, so you've got basically 81,000 men getting closer and closer. And by this day, you know, on the 30th, the Union Army has finally arrived and stretched out in a line almost 3 miles long, starting at the Stones River to the north and, you know, heading to the south. And they're going to be facing one another. The two generals, Rosecrans and Bragg, will be putting together their plans. And as the sun goes down and it gets really, really cold and, you know, it's muddy because it's rained three out of the preceding
like
4 days.
New Year's in Nashville over the last few years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But then at that moment, though, that evening, one of the most incredible, and this is why history is way cooler than fiction, because you can't make this stuff up. You know, one of the most amazing things happened because, as you know, as men are trying to bed down as a way to sort of lift their spirits, they have military bands with them, and they start playing, you know, their various tunes. And some of them shared by both sides, but of course, you know, south, you know, southern side.
As you're saying this, I'm wondering, can they hear each other as this is going?
Oh, yeah. It's a cacophony, actually. I mean, I'm not sure how, if I was a soldier lying on the ground trying to get to sleep and I'm hearing all these bands play, I'm not sure it's really lifting my spirits or not, but
that's a true Tennessee experience.
Yeah. But it's a battle of the bands. I mean, you know, you got Confederate trying to outdo Union, and actually you've got the Union bands are trying to outdo each other, and so are the Confederates, and they're getting louder and louder, and they're playing all these different songs.
Are the bands protected during these?
Well, the armies are still about, you know, half to three quarters of a mile apart, so they're not. Yeah,
because I'm just wondering if these players are having like a drum off, and then they know they're going to be shooting each other the next day.
Well, see, the musicians get detailed to go and help with the hospital, so they're not going to pick up guns.
Okay,
so they
know they're in the clear.
Well, sort of. They got to deal with the aftermath. I don't know. I think I'd rather be out there with a gun, to be honest with you. But anyway, one of the bands, and nobody knows who, but this is documented, you know, from several sources, starts to play a tune that had only recently kind of entered the American consciousness, both North and South, called Home Sweet Home. And one by one, bit by bit, every single band takes up that song.
Really?
And according to some accounts, even some of the soldiers start to sing because, I mean, some soldiers are from right here in Murfreesboro. They're literally fighting for Home Sweet Home, of course. Yeah. And for any soldier contemplating battle the next day, the top thing on their mind is home and the fact that they may never see it again. And so when that last strain dies out, you could have heard a pin drop on this battlefield.
Wow.
And, you know, it's just, like I said, it's just one of those moments where you can't dream this up. And it's a very poignant and emotional moment, I'm sure, for, you know, it's for us listening, you know, thinking about it now, but certainly for them, knowing what we know that, you know, 158 years from now on December 31st, it's going to be hell itself on earth.
Wow.
Wow.
I want to get some context for the setting up of, you know, what happened and everything. And what we had said before the podcast really intrigued me because you said a lot of this starts in Kansas. I just came back from Kansas, so I'm actually pretty curious to hear.
Literally like 2 days ago, I came back from Kansas.
Just drove back. So I'm actually pretty curious to hear how that context really leads us into some of this.
Into the Civil War. About. Well, yeah. I mean, the break, you know, the nation's been grappling with the issue of slavery and the balance of power vis-a-vis that institution for some time, really since our founding. Of course, the big piece that has been sort of holding things together has been the Missouri Compromise and compromises that follow later that sort of, as the nation grows, you keep the number of free versus slave states relatively even. So, in particularly in the U.S. Senate, you have a balance of power. Well, when the Kansas-Nebraska Act hits the ground, that's
so like 1853.
Yeah, 53 or 54. Okay. I mean, but when the Kansas-Nebraska Act hits the ground, that ends it because what that basically says is we're no longer following this little line, you know, the little line, you know. Saying north of this, it's free, south of it's slave. Now, every remaining state that will be created will be able to vote basically on whether it's free or slave. And then when, you know, although we say the shooting war in the Civil War begins with the firing on Fort Sumter in April of 1861, one could say that the shooting war started a little bit earlier than that because, you know, the way they jockeyed for position and campaigned to decide whether Kansas would be free or slave is basically each side armed itself, and actually people poured into the state from other places, you know, pro or anti-slavery, and they started killing one another. Wow. With the idea is that basically whoever has the most people breathing on voting day, that's what will be Kansas's fate. And that's why we refer to it as Bleeding Kansas. That's where John Brown, who becomes famous for his raid on Harper's Ferry, he will cut his teeth in violence against slavery in the wars, wars going on in Kansas.
Wow.
I don't think I've ever heard that before.
I was going to say, I knew driving into Kansas, there are tons of signs to let you know of their history and everything. So I looked it up a little bit, but you know, wasn't able to hear the full context like that. So I think it's very interesting how all of that has kind of led to where we are today. Obviously, a few weeks ago, we talked about the Battle of Nashville on our podcast.
Yeah, I listened to that.
The occupation of Nashville. And obviously now we're in Murfreesboro and talking about Stones River. So timeline, this is about a year after the occupation of Nashville?
Not quite a year yet, but I mean, Nashville will basically fall to Union hands really without firing a shot because of the fall of Fort Donelson.
Right.
Because once Fort Donelson falls, the Union Riverboat Navy, the big ironclads, can travel the Cumberland River right up to Second Avenue. Which
you said there's like three or four of them right there on like at the Cumberland River in downtown Nashville.
Yeah. I mean, so no matter how good your earthworks are, no matter how many men you have in the city, if they can just drive their gunboats right up into the middle of town, there's nothing you can do about it. So the Confederates rightly evacuate Nashville. And then Nashville will be on its way to, you know, it will basically be the hub of Union operations in the Western Theater for the next, you know, year and a half or so.
And the Western Theater is anything considered west of the, North Carolina, right?
Of the Appalachian Mountains, okay.
So how did this, how did that all lead to Murfreesboro? Why was it Murfreesboro where the Confederate and the federal troops ended up meeting here? Why this place?
Because once Nashville falls, the next most important, the next city that's important now from the Union perspective and the Confederate is Chattanooga. And so when the Kentucky campaign ends and the Confederates leave Kentucky, they head down to Chattanooga. The Union will eventually come down to Nashville. General Bragg, though, realizing that, you know, for anybody who's been in Chattanooga, you realize you're in a bowl surrounded by mountains. Chattanooga itself is not a great place to defend. You can't defend Chattanooga from Chattanooga.
Right, because you're sitting inside the bowl.
You have to be on top of Lookout Mountain to be able to defend Chattanooga.
And then some. So what Bragg decides is to move his army here to the flatlands of Middle Tennessee in the Nashville Basin. He will forward defend Chattanooga. The other reason he comes here, though, is because this is where his food's coming from. The rich agricultural production of Middle Tennessee. And in 1860, the three biggest money-making crops in Tennessee. I'll give you a guess. What's the first one?
Tobacco.
Nope.
Corn.
There you go. It's corn, pigs, horses.
Ah.
Every one of those, the cotton is fourth. So corn feeds men and horses. Pigs feed the men. Horses move everything. So those three agricultural products of this region are critical for control. And if you're in Chattanooga 100 miles away and the enemy is in Nashville 30 miles away, who controls it?
Yeah.
So Bragg puts himself right on top of his supply base to defend it, but also to defend Chattanooga. So that's why this place becomes, and the reason he chose Murfreesboro is that road network I talked about. You look in Murfreesboro, it looks like it's at the center of a little spider web on a map. And then, of course, also running through it is the Nashville and Chattanooga Railroad, which Bragg surely knows is going to be the main artery of supply for the Union Army.
So there was a few train stations here in Murfreesboro for that line, correct?
There is a station in Murfreesboro. Yeah. Murfreesboro is a really big city now. In 1860, it was about 3,000 people.
Yeah.
Okay.
So half of whom were owned by the other half.
Okay.
So it's about 1,500 free whites and about 1,500 enslaved, then a couple thousand more in the Rutherford County area. But this was not a flourishing town by standards of the day, but it was not like we are now, where we're trying to get ourselves ready to give Nashville a run for its money.
Yeah, Murfreesboro is I think in the last year and a half, the fastest growing city in America.
My 23 years here, we've been on the top 5 or 10 list, almost every one of them. It's pretty incredible, actually.
Crazy. Wow. So we're in the context of now we have, you know, we know why people are fighting over the town of Murfreesboro. It's a supply line, and, you know, it can help lead to many other advancements for either side. So, you know, I like the story that you told earlier of both sides coming in. You said December 30th is the eve of the battle.
Although there's some serious fighting here, don't get me. I mean, there are guys that, you know, the Union right wing has to literally fight its way into position. So there's a fair amount of banging and booming going on, particularly south of where the park sits today, as the last bit of the Union army kind of wrenches its way into position. But the main battle, where almost every one of the 81,000 soldiers that are in these two armies will get into the fight, is going to begin at dawn on December 31st, 1862.
Wow.
And, you know, we did cover why here, but then there's always the question a lot of people ask is why the when? Who in the right mind? I mean, because you guys said it sounds, you know, we talked about the rain and everything. It sounds like Nashville in the winter. Yeah. I mean, winter is not, most times in winter, nothing happening. Yeah. Okay, because, you know, you're relying on men marching and horses and mules pulling wagons, and you're mostly on roads that are dirt, reed, mud, when you have rain and snow and all that kind of stuff. So why in the heck is the Union Army moving out of Nashville at a time when it should just be cooling its heels and waiting for the spring? Mm. And then combine that, look at it from the 10,000-foot level. The Army of the Potomac fights a battle in mid-December at Fredericksburg.
Yeah, and that's when the Union lost a severe battle.
Perhaps. They lost.
Yeah.
But just before this battle, the Army of the Tennessee, Grant's Army, will fight a battle outside of Vicksburg at Chickasaw Bayou. And this Army will fight a battle before the end of the year in 1862. Something's up. Why are all three major Union armies fighting at the end of the year of 1862? Because on January 1st, 1863... the Emancipation Proclamation is scheduled to go into effect. And that document, written under Lincoln's authority as Commander-in-Chief of the United States Armed Forces, requires military success to back it up.
Mm. Yeah. So what's really interesting is I just watched the movie Glory,
mm-hmm.
And it was about the 54th Battalion and how freed slaves or freedmen joined the army and they fought in South Carolina, and it's just fascinating because
and that comes from the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah, okay.
There are two paragraphs in there in that proclamation that basically say from this point forward, African Americans may serve in the army and fight for their own freedom.
And it was what, nearly 240,000 men signed up.
By the end of the war, they made up almost 10% of the entire Union Army.
Wow.
It's a big deal. This is a game changer because, you know, Emancipation Proclamation, and we could spend the whole time talking about that.
Sure.
Of course, really does not actually free a single slave. The way it's worded, Lincoln, it was nothing if not a crafty politician. But it does basically, it does change the focus. You know, the war going into January 1st is purportedly about restoring the Union, which restore means put back the way it was.
Mm. Yeah, and it's, what's really interesting is the marketing campaigns at that time, especially in like Massachusetts and New York, was, hey, we need to restore the Union.
Yeah. Well, and I think that was true. I mean, that's, and it remains a war aim, but after January 1st, 1863, it's remake the Union. You know, the following year, Lincoln will talk about in the Gettysburg Address, giving the nation a new birth of freedom. Well, that new birth starts midnight January 1st, 1863, if he has military success to back it up. And as you noted, Fredericksburg was not that victory, nor was the Battle of Chickasaw Bayou. So when this thing gets going on December 31st, this is Lincoln's last shot to get that victory.
Wow. If victory didn't happen here, would the Civil War have been different?
Almost certainly. It's hard to say how and why, but one thing's for sure, the Emancipation Proclamation would have been perceived a whole lot differently because, I mean, again, that document is issued under his authority as Commander-in-Chief.
So it would have seemed either that proclamation was given some weight or it would have been, really kind of not looked at as seriously, depending on
I think it would have been looked on as sort of a desperate act by a nation that was in the process of losing the fight.
Mm.
Would it have brought Britain or France into the war? I think historians debate on that, and many come down and say, no, neither one of those guys was ever going to really commit to siding with the Confederacy that was fighting for, in part, the explicit means of keeping people enslaved, because neither one of those countries had slavery anymore. But
isn't, I don't know if this is true, and I've heard this through the grapevine, but didn't the French send 50,000 soldiers that landed in South Carolina at some point?
I've never heard of that.
Okay.
50,000 would have been pretty well known. That would have been in the declaration of war.
Okay. Because I've heard somewhere, I don't know where
I've heard it. In fact, at this stage of the game, France is very, in foreign policy, France is very subservient to Britain in a lot of ways.
Which makes sense.
If Britain doesn't make a move, France is not likely to make a move either. The French were not the ones that the Confederates were mostly focused on. It was, if you get the British to go, then maybe you could get something, you know, something going. But but certainly, you know, even here in the United States, the perception of the proclamation would have been, I think, a whole lot different if you've got nothing good to show for it as it goes into effect. And so Lincoln is, I'm sure, sweating it out, waiting for news at the telegraph office when this battle gets going.
Yeah. Wow. So you have this big, which I think, you know, sometimes you think surely people just didn't sit 3/4 of a mile away from each other waiting overnight to kill each other the next day. But that's exactly what we have here, kind of like what you think of for a lot of Civil War, you know, battles obviously happen differently. But this one was a true wait until the morning and then we kill each other kind of deal. So how did that, obviously we have the nighttime where the bands were having their battle of the bands, and then what happened after that?
Well, while that's going on, the both generals are coming up with their plans, and you know, it doesn't surprise you when you figure that they both sat in the same classrooms listening to the same teachers at West Point, that they come up with essentially the same attack plan, which is to try to get around their enemy's right
and
into his rear line. And cut off his supply line. And now Rosecrans's plan is a little more involved because he needs to cross the Stones River in order to do that. So his plan, his attack is going to take a little longer to sort of come into play. When the sun comes up, his guys begin filing across the river, but then they're going to have to, you know, get over there, get online, begin their attack, and ultimately get into Murfreesboro, whereas Bragg has lined his guys up so that he's pretty sure that his lines overlap the end of the Union right, which is what we say unanchored. It doesn't have any kind of a hill or river or anything to sort of protect it. It's just sitting out in the open, which is a big no-no when you're fighting in these linear formations because your most vulnerable point is the end of the line.
Yeah.
And Bragg, you know, basically his orders are simple. When the sun comes up, attack. Come forward, hit that right end of the line, start swinging like a door on a hinge up towards the Nashville Pike and to the north. Every succeeding unit to the north is basically looking to its left, and when they see the guys to their left move forward, they move forward. It's what's called an echelon attack, so it'll be like the first hit and then bang, 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 bang all the way up the line to keep the rest of the Union Army kind of guessing as to what is the main attack, but also keeping them busy so that ever-growing, as more and more guys run away, more groups will join that swinging door. Will swing around and slam shut across the Nashville Pike and cut the Union Army off from Nashville, their base of supply and their retreat. And for the first hour and a half, 2 hours or so, it looks like that's exactly what's going to happen. The Confederates come in, the Union forces down there on the right wing. Not only do they have a exposed flank, but they're sitting around campfires, boiling coffee and making their breakfast.
No way.
And they get routed hard. The first division of the Union Army under Richard Johnson evaporates probably in less than 20 minutes.
Wow. Did they just not see that?
Oh, they knew they were there, but remember, you know, these are young men, for the most part. You've been marching and fighting over the course of 4 days. You are given permission that morning to actually have a little bit of a warm meal. Yeah, by God, you're going to take it. And you do have guys out there in front of you called skirmishers that are supposed to, when they see the enemy come, shoot their guns and, something's happening. But the skirmish line over on the right flank saw this huge wave of, you know, thousands of Confederates coming way, and they just peed their pants and ran away. And so there is no warning. Wow. I mean, there's a great account from a Sergeant Major Lyman Whitney of the 36th Illinois Infantry. His job that morning was to go out and check the skirmish line, and he was nearly run over by his skirmishers as he was heading out there to check them. He decides to go a little farther just to see what the heck was going on. And, you know, he kind of recounts seeing this, you know, gray wave coming his way, and, you know, he turns and hightails it too. And so it's, you know, it looks like the, you know, the Confederate plan is going to work very well in the early stages of the battle.
So I assume the weather conditions at this moment is it's foggy because of the rain the last couple of days. you're starting to have some cannon fire at this time.
Yeah, so it's certainly muddy. From what we can tell, there's no real precipitation on the 3 days of the Battle of Stones River. There's a couple of reports of a shower here or there, but it's relatively cloudy. It's muddy. It's cold. It gets below freezing at night. We know this because there are accounts come the end of the day on the 31st, beginning of January 1st, of men literally freezing to the ground in their own blood.
Wow.
And that's salt water. So that's pretty cold. I mean, so, you know, it's pretty miserable conditions. And yeah, I mean, trying to move men on foot is one thing. Artillery is, it got a real problem, you know, trying to get across fields and muddy roads. I mean, it weighs a lot, and so it's going to sink down in this clay-ridden mud pretty quickly. And that, coupled with growing Union resistance, you know, in the beginning, the Confederates just wipe out Johnson's division, but the next two divisions in line, Jefferson C. Davis, not to be confused with the president of the Confederacy, and Philip Sheridan, although ultimately Davis's division will also be driven from the field and Sheridan will have to give ground and pull himself up above the Wilkinson Pike, which is today the southern boundary of the park, they will begin slowing down that advance and buying valuable time. Wow. And then Sheridan and Negley will, James Negley, who's a part of the center wing of the army, right up where our tour stop number two is down at the southern end of the park today, will then from about 10 a.m. until noon, those five Union brigades will stand off against nine Confederate brigades and hold them in position for about 2 hours.
Really? Wow.
So almost half the Confederate army just gets stopped cold. Now, ultimately, the Confederates will break through that position. It'll be a bloodbath. In fact, that area would later be christened the Slaughter Pen.
So that was more probably hand-on-hand combat?
Not hand-to-hand, but, I mean, just a lot of really close up in the woods. And people will go down there. Really can see how terrain impacts the battle there, because here in Middle Tennessee, you know, everybody, you know, we have all those little outcroppings of limestone and stuff jutting up out of the ground. Well, it was like a ready-made fortress for the Union guys. I mean, they're sitting in those rocks behind the trees, wailing away at the Confederates, and they're, you know, they're getting the better of it for the first couple hours. But when the Confederates finally attack this position that's sort of a V-shape from all sides and collapse Sheridan's line, because his men have been, God, they've been fighting for almost 4 hours straight.
Wow.
The men that are in the rocks get almost cut off. Wow. And then they realize, oh, yeah, well, this is a great place to hide. This is a really crummy place to run.
Yeah.
And getting out of there was, you know, so when they turn and try to pick their way out of them rocks, they're sitting ducks. So yeah, this it's one of the most beautiful spots on the battlefield when you visit it today. But I mean, then you think about what it really looked like back then. I mean, it must have been just awful.
Did you have in this, because I know, you know, we're sitting in Tennessee, which you know, had to kind of make up its mind on which side of the war.
Took them a while, too. They were the last ones to secede.
Was in this battle, did you have the possibility of brother fighting against brother?
You did. It's actually a more rare occurrence than most people think, because the vast majority of the Union soldiers, you know, come from places like Ohio and Indiana and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, and the, you know, Confederates are from Tennessee and North Carolinas and Mississippi and stuff. So there are some rare occasions, particularly when you talk about, there are some East Tennessee regiments here, so they may have had family fighting in Tennessee regiments, Kentucky, another divided state, which actually stayed loyal to the Union, but you actually have Kentucky soldiers. And I do recall, you know, in our files with you know, some of the letters and diaries, there was, in fact, one Kentucky soldier who didn't, in fact, come upon his commanding officer actually saw him kind of leaning over this body, and he got onto him because he thought he was looting the body. And, you know, the young man turned around with tears in his eyes and said, "No, sir, this is my brother."
Wow.
You know, because he wasn't looting him. He was trying to, you know, find the last letter, you know, something to send home to his parents. So it can happen, but, you know, interestingly enough, I mean, most guys on one side don't know the guys on the other side at all. to a large degree.
So I kind of cut you off at a big cliffhanger. So it seems like at this point in the war, the Confederates have a pretty good hand.
Yeah, by noon, even, you know, once the Slaughter Pen salient breaks, by noon, I would say that, you know, and I ask this question when I'm giving tours is, you know, what do you all think? Who's winning? And, you know, almost everybody says Confederates. And, you know, from the perspective of the soldier on the ground, I would say that's true. But the one thing about Bragg's attack plan, you know, enveloping and driving the enemy back towards his thing, he's actually, and we can't show people because, you know, this is all audio, but, you know, if you wrap, you know, you're driving the enemy into an ever tighter ball.
So you can ultimately surround them.
So the key to success of that kind of attack is to never let up. Because if you let him breathe, if you let him draw another line in the sand, and then you kind of start up again, your very success is making his new line stronger. Well, during that delay in the slaughter pen, General Rosecrans is doing just that. He's drawing a new line in the sand here by our visitor center along the Nashville Pike, which is his lifeline back to Nashville. He has canceled his attack across the river. He has switched gears now. He's going on the defensive. And he lays out a big, long, two-mile horseshoe-shaped line to protect his positions along the Nashville Pike and the railroad.
And so I assume that bordered the river and then went up.
Yeah, okay. Come the river down across the Nashville Pike, ride up a little bit, and then swing back the other way. And so it's like I said, you've just like a big U that's all kind of squashed out. And then once the Confederates get through the big chunk of woods that was known by both sides as the Cedars, that you can still see out here on the battlefield today, and emerge at the ends of those tree lines looking, you know, about a half mile to the Nashville Pike, they see nothing but a solid wall of blue.
Wow.
And behind that wall of blue are dozens of cannons. Union artillery is massed on the rise of ground between the pike and the railroad, where our national cemetery sits today. And it must have been a daunting sight.
And the Confederates at this point, they've been fighting for hours to get
many of them have been fighting since 6 o'clock in the morning. They've had to resupply at least once. And even after that, because there's also, you know, they because of serious fighting before they were right there, they might be reaching down. They only have 4 or 5 rounds left in their cartridge boxes.
Wow.
God love them. They still go. Because the promised land is the road.
Yeah.
I mean, they know they've been, they're actually, believe it or not, the Confederates are the more experienced army. Vast majority of the Union soldiers have maybe fought in one battle up in Kentucky, like Perryville or the Battle of Richmond. Many others were, they were all kind of gathering there in late 1862 for their first assignment, so they just kind of got grabbed by the Union Army.
Wow.
So there's a lot of them actually having their first battle, whereas most of the Army of Tennessee, these guys have been at Shiloh. They've been through the campaign in Kentucky. These are hard-bitten soldiers. They know their job, and so when they see, yeah, it's a solid wall of blue. Yeah, there's all them cannons there. Oh, and by the way, when we look back through them woods, guess how many of our cannons are coming to help us?
Not very many.
None.
The limestone.
Because they can't get through the woods and the rocks and everything else like that. So all the Confederate artillery stops short at the Wilkinson Pike. So it's a mile away at that point. They still decide to go. Now it's kind of fitful at first, but as one Union soldier described it, it was sort of like watching the tide come in at the tide come in, each wave would come, break, fall back, only to be replaced by another ever bigger one, and it would get closer and closer. They actually drove and bent the Union Army line back right where we're talking right now here, kind of in that center portion of the horseshoe. They actually pushed the Union infantry back to within about 30 yards of the road.
Wow.
But ultimately, the Union artillery, which would basically had complete superiority across these fields.
Because they had the hill.
And no opposition.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't have to worry about counter-battery fire. All they got to do is say, how many Rebs focus can I kill with this shot?
Wow.
And they just keep tearing into them until the Confederates can't take anymore. And ultimately, by the end of the day on the 31st, the Confederates will fall back to the trees. The Union Army will kind of, you know, stay where it is. And lo and behold, from those heady moments of the beginning of the battle where it looked like the Confederates were on their way to a war-changing victory, Now the Union at least has salvaged the draw, has managed to stop the Confederate tide. But as we look back on it so many years later, this is really, I mean, the battle at this point is more or less over. The Union has basically said, you know, this far, no farther. Wow. You either got to keep coming or leave.
So I know you said that the battle obviously goes until the 2nd. Yeah. So where is that official line really drawn?
Right. Well, so that's the big day, the 31st. Now, January 1st is a day of sort of rest and reorganization. The Union has been beaten in battle. And don't get me wrong. I mean, the Confederates beat them like a drum on the 31st. I mean, they took a 3-mile-long line, bent it backwards more than 90 degrees, and shaved about a mile off of it.
At this point, how many casualties were there?
It's tough to say because they don't report it phase by phase, but the Union Army probably sustained a goodly bit of its about 30% casualties in that first day. Now, so did the Confederates, but they're going to add a little cherry on top of the sundae on January 2nd that will, you know, by almost 2,000. Mm. So they're not quite done yet with their bloodbath, if you will. I would say, you know, probably close to 80 to 85% of the casualties of the battle will take place on December 31st.
Okay.
After that, you know, both sides will kind of, you know, try to reorganize, resupply. They start gathering up wounded as they can. Although if you're a poor guy like Ed Abbott, who we feature up in our museum, he was shot and had his leg broken south of the Wilkinson Pike. He was a gunner on one of the cannons. He lay on the field. He was now basically a mile behind enemy lines. He lay on the field for 9 days until help could come for him.
Wow.
Good rule of thumb. If you get magically transported back in time to a Civil War battle, get wounded late. Because that means you're around the two armies. And so when the truce is declared, like it was on January 1st, and they go out and police up the dead and the wounded, you can get taken care of.
Yeah.
But the other thing is both sides dig in. They start piling up dirt, rocks, fence rails, trees, basically World War One in trench lines. In no man's land, which means it's going to be even harder for anybody to make any kind of a move in that area where they had fought previously. And then on the end of the day, the Union will send a division of soldiers, about 4,400 men, across the Stones River up onto a hill overlooking McFadden's Ford, which is the highest ground on the battlefield.
Gotcha.
So when the day dawns on January 2nd and John Breckinridge, who commands the Confederate forces on the east side of the river, he has a division himself of about 4,500 men. He sees the Union up on that hill. They're trenching in. They've even got a few cannons up there. And he reports back to Bragg, you know, what's going on. And Bragg gives him the order to attack and take that hill. Now, this is an order that everybody and their brother, when they come in here, they say, that blankety blank blank Bragg. Bragg gets what he deserves as a pitiful tactical commander. I would actually argue he is not a moron, nor is he as bad as a lot of people think he is, but that's for another time. And in this case, his order to take the hill is tactically sound because he means to stay and fight. If you mean to stay and fight and win the battle, can you allow the enemy to occupy the high ground and put its artillery on that high ground?
Definitely not. Yeah.
No. So what do you have to do?
You have to retake.
You got to take the high ground, no matter how much it costs. It is tactically sound. My problem with Bragg is, why does he feel like he has to stay here? By the end of the 31st, he already realizes Union artillery controls the bulk of the battlefield and that his men have no prayer of taking the Nashville Pike. So his ultimate plan of cutting the Union Army off is pretty much done at this point, okay? And his overall strategy for Middle Tennessee is, if I can't hold Murfreesboro, I'm going to fall back towards Shelbyville and Tullahoma. I've got the Duck River and the Elk River.
Right.
I can use them like Lee uses the Rappahannock and the Rapidan I lose part of Middle Tennessee, but I still keep the enemy away from Chattanooga. So this is part of his long-term plan. So why doesn't he do it? He should know by now. It's because on the evening of the 31st, he sent a telegram back to Richmond that more or less declared victory.
Really?
Wow.
And so God has granted us a happy new year. Well, He's a little concerned that if he sends another telegram saying I was just kidding, he might get fired.
Oh, man.
And this is where I part company with Bragg or any commander that makes a decision that will kill his men based on his career prospects.
Yeah.
I got no use for him.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's essentially where this decision comes from. Breckinridge doesn't want to make the attack, but ultimately he's a good soldier. He'll set it up. He does it as essentially as a bayonet charge. And it's initially quite successful. His biggest concern, besides the men entrenched on the hill in front of him, is actually Union artillery on the west bank of the Stones River that can fire into his flank and kind of command the field over which this fight's going to happen. So he decides to wait till 4 o'clock.
So this is
sun's coming down on January 2nd, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is January 2nd now. He waits till the sun's going down. The idea here is if he's successful in taking the hill, it'll be dark and there won't be any way for the enemy to counterattack. Plus, as it's getting darker, it's getting harder for the enemy artillery to judge distance or distinguish color.
Mm. Wow.
Which is why he wants a bayonet charge, because a bayonet charge puts you on right up next to the enemy.
Yeah.
Makes it really hard for them to pick their targets.
Wow.
Well, 4 o'clock, they kick off. They actually, 15 minutes, 20 minutes later, they've actually blown the Union forces off that hill.
Wow.
Then they have to decide what to do next. Unfortunately, they follow what is actually a good military tenet, which is if you got them on the run, keep them on the run. You know, the enemy is, you know, running down towards the river, scampering away. So they reform their lines, start pouring down towards McFadden's Ford, the crossing in the river, pressing the enemy. But as they're coming down that long slope, 57 Union cannons lined up along the west bank of the Stones River are pounding away at them.
Wow.
Union infantry will set up on the opposite bank and start firing into them. By the time we reach about 4:45, the Confederates are falling back in relatively good order. I'll give them credit for that. But they are white about 1,800 men.
Mm.
Breckinridge loses 40% of his command in less than an hour.
Oh, my
God. It's one of the most devastating artillery actions of the entire Civil War.
Wow.
The Union will counter-assault. They'll send twice the number of troops back across the river. Basically, both sides end up in the same spot they were at the beginning of the day on January 2nd, but it's not a draw. Because now, you know, Breckinridge is facing twice his number of men on the east bank of the river. Nothing has changed over here on the west bank. The Union artillery still controls everything along the Nashville Pike. Now it's obvious they also control the riverbank and the river valley. And Rosecrans is perfectly set up to, you know, we've almost come full circle. Remember, what was Rosecrans's plan? Cross the river, head down into Murfreesboro, cut off. Well, now he's got twice as many men as Breckinridge's shot up, beaten and battered division, just ready to move south and smash into Murfreesboro.
Did Breckinridge know at this point that that Bragg had sent back that letter to?
I don't know that he knows about the telegram at all. No.
Yeah. Makes you wonder, you know, how much did they know about why they continued that fight instead of going to try and continue to protect the Chattanooga area.
Yeah. Although Breckinridge probably did always generally assumed the worst, because, I mean, well, the Army of Tennessee, that Confederate Army, I mean, one of the things that hampered it most, and it does start with the top with Bragg, but nobody in that command structure could get along with each other. Mm-hmm. They were terrible. You know, everybody is always either stabbing somebody in the back or watching their back. And not busy trying to work together as a team. Mm. You know, there's an older book, but a good one, called Two Great Rebel Armies by Stephen. Was that Stephen Woodworth or was that? I can't remember. But it's a great book because it compares the Army of Northern Virginia to the Army of Tennessee.
Wow.
And it's not the men,
it's the command.
It's the command, the command style, the fostering of teamwork, and particularly that Army of Tennessee prior to or leading up to the Battle of Chancellorsville. That sort of changes even in the Army of Northern Virginia in Chancellorsville because you lose Jackson. You have to add a corps commander, and so that kind of changes the dynamic in that army. But that period of time where it was Lee, Jackson, and Longstreet, man, I mean, those guys like read each other's thoughts and, always look to do the right thing for the, that wasn't happening here. Mm. It just was not happening. And conversely, one of Rosecrans's greatest strengths as a commander, and even though he's a relatively new one, he really begins working very hard as soon as he takes command of this army of, building an esprit de corps, empowering his sub-commanders to make decisions on the field, that will sort of follow the broader outlines of what we want to accomplish, but not necessarily hang them out to dry if it doesn't work.
Yeah. Wow.
And so you know, it's a team versus a collection of individuals.
So is Bragg done at this point? Is this worth the surrender? Really?
The irony of it all is he will not be removed from command. In fact, once they retreat to Tullahoma and Shelbyville following, on the 3rd and 4th, they will evacuate, the Confederates will evacuate Murfreesboro, head down, and Bragg will set up his base down by Shelbyville and ultimately Tullahoma. And then on January 5th, the Union Army will march into Murfreesboro and, yay, we won. Although really the battle is over on January 2nd.
Yeah.
Shortly after that, Bragg will actually send a little letter around to all of his commanders asking them if the Army still had confidence in them, and if not, should he, leave.
Wow.
And surprise, surprise, like 80% of them said no and yes. And all that does is tick him off, and he just starts transferring people away or going after the people that said, I mean, again, it continues after this battle, and this is kind of the beginning of the end.
Sure.
The Confederates, this is their last really good chance to sort of shift the tide of the war here in the Western Theater. After this, when the Union comes in, the Union Army comes out after 6 months of retooling, incorporating innovations like, Wilder forms his Lightning Brigade of mounted infantry firing Spencer rifles at Murfreesboro. New technologies, new systems like the Signal Corps are more intimately involved. I mean, Rosecrans is building this, well-oiled machine team. And meanwhile, the command structure of the Army of Tennessee is killing more trees than an entire national force with paper, going back and forth to Richmond, blaming each other and trying to get people transferred, fired, and everything else, while the men do their job and drill, 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 and prepare for the next fight. It's not the men's fault. And when they come out and meet each other, I'm just finishing up the most recent book that came out on the battle on the Tullahoma campaign. These two armies that were so evenly matched and slugged it out, lost almost 24,000 casualties, killed, wounded, and captured. About a third,
the Battle of Stones River.
About a third of both armies go down. I mean, wow. It's like two heavyweight fighters going to the 15th round and hugging each other. And essentially, the Confederates just don't answer the bell on the last round. That's why the Union Army wins. They leave, right? I mean, they are evenly matched. They stand toe-to-toe. Tullahoma campaign, the Union Army is an entirely different animal, and the Confederates don't know what to do with it. Mm. And they maneuver and drive the Confederates completely out of Tennessee, and then by late summer, early fall, have taken Chattanooga without having to even fight a major battle.
Wow.
So you're seeing the beginnings of that here on this battlefield, but it's still a very, it's a bloodbath. And, the percentage of casualties here at Stones River is the highest rate of casualties for two armies engaged during the Civil War period.
Wow. That's crazy. Thank you for telling us all about that battle and everything. How does the Battle of Stones River affect modern day Middle Tennessee?
Well, I mean, for one, there's a national park here. Sure. So that obviously, you know, because there was a battle here, we have a national park and we are a big part of our community and our economy, for sure. So it certainly affects us that way. You know, to be blunt, the Civil War, I mean, this is true not only in Middle Tennessee, but in the South. I mean, it happened here. And so it's a little more palpable. I grew up in New Jersey, you know, up there. Revolutionary War sites, when you go, you know, if you live in Morristown.
Battle of Morristown.
Right. Yeah. Well, the camp at Morristown. But, yeah, I mean, you know, all over the place there. I mean, that stuff happened there. Even, you know, our revolution was, you know, technically a civil war, too.
Yeah.
It was British subjects fighting British subjects. You call a revolution when the side not in power wins. You call the civil war when the side in power wins.
Yeah.
It's semantics. But, you know, so there was some of that family split and brother versus brother stuff going on with that.
Yeah.
Well, here in the South, you know, the Civil War happened here. I mean, Murfreesboro, after the Battle of Stones River, becomes an occupied town. We mentioned, you know, churches are torn down. Government is suspended. Martial law. You know, the economy is ruined. You know, when this war is over. In fact, one of the greatest things I've ever heard was if you want to understand why the Civil War is so, you know, still such, you know, such a big thing, one way to think about it is the state of Mississippi. In 1860, Mississippi's net wealth, its GDP, placed it as the fourth richest state in the country. Now, granted, a lot of that was actually the value of owned human beings.
Yeah.
Okay. Since the end of the Civil War, Mississippi has never been out of the bottom two or three.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just, my wife and I went down.
They have never recovered from the Civil War.
Yeah.
Literally.
And you could see that.
Yeah.
Driving down the Natchez Trace, you can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the scars are still there. I mean, I still speak to families who have roots, you know, here, and not just Confederate, but folks, you know, that had Unionists in the family tree. I mean, those stories, those pains have been passed down and passed down, and you drive by the places where it happened every single day. And the earthworks of Fortress Rosecrans still partially stand outside of Murfreesboro, the battlefield, the National Cemetery. You know, we look at it generally as a good thing, an enriching thing, in a way for us to kind of grapple with and remember and learn from our past. And I think most people do as well. But it can also still be a symbol of pain. You have to realize that as well. I mean, the this is where it happened.
As somebody who gets to, you know, kind of look at, be around, and be surrounded by history and you know, teach history every day, what do you consider as some of the most important things that we can take away from, you know, the education of either the Civil War or history in general? Why do you think it's important that this stuff is really studied?
Well, I mean, you know, the Civil War period is such a dynamic and formative period in our nation's history that I don't know that we never have to go through quite as awful a transformative process as that. It changed a lot of things. I mean, we had a constitution and whatnot, you know, coming into this war, but, you know, the idea of, you know, the balance of power between the federal and the states. I mean, for good or ill,
right?
You know, the Civil War solved that in the favor of the federal. You know, and we still argue about that.
Sure.
I mean, there's no doubt about that. You know, of course, the biggest thing, and one of my buddies says, you know, but, you know, if the Civil War didn't end up the way it is, we might all be speaking German right now. You know, because, you know, like Shelby Foote said, you know, one of the greatest things the Civil War did is, that, you know, before the Civil War, if you use the proper noun United States in a sentence, you said the United States are. It was a plural noun. Today, we say without batting an eye, the United States is.
Mm-hmm.
Changed us from an R to an S.
Interesting.
It made us in many ways into a country. And thankfully, a country that had taken a pretty large step forward towards meeting the ideals that had been expressed in our Declaration of Independence.
Yeah.
You know, without the fuse of slavery on the powder keg, it's quite likely we would not have come to such a terrible conflict. And I think, you know, things like the Emancipation Proclamation and then ultimately the 13th Amendment coming in is basically the Lincoln administration realizing that if we end this war and we don't get rid of this, we're going to fight this again.
Yeah. Right.
And we need not to, because this is just wrong.
Yeah. And continuing until we end up living up to the ideals of
And actually right after the Civil War, we take, you know, it's more than just the end of slavery. That's the 13th Amendment, but then you got the 14th and the 15th following right on it. I mean, there is a moment in time, and it doesn't last very long, where, you know, we have taken, you know, the country has taken some pretty big strides, but at least those things have been enshrined in the Constitution, because they are going to be the basis upon which 100 years later,
right,
you have a civil rights movement.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing is, when I take people out, and particularly on walks through the cemetery, which, you know, if you walk through our national cemetery, all of our soldiers are kind of mixed up. They're not by state. And in several sections, there are United States colored troop soldiers and that buried next to white soldiers, which, of course, you would have never seen in 1860 anywhere, north or south. OK, blacks next to whites. So there was something, you know, it kind of gives you a sense on the landscape that things have changed after the Civil War.
Yeah.
By the time you get to the other side of the cemetery in our post-Civil War sections, for a while, Section P and Section Q were doing burials at the same time because they were segregated.
Mm. Wow.
And when I take people on that walk, I say, you know, it's the process in this nation. It's, you know, we're never going to probably truly meet every ideal in the Declaration of Independence. But we keep struggling that way.
Right.
And so the Civil War, because it is such a struggle over, you know, some issues that still are important to us today, you know, power, political power, unity, you know, and rights, freedoms of people, you know, as we continue to have those debates, whether it be black and white or, you know, homosexual, you know, versus this or whatever it may be, you know, all those discussions we have and all those struggles we have over what it means to be American and what it means to be, you know, to have rights as a citizen of this nation, all can be informed by what happens in the Civil War.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us here on the Nashville Daily Podcast and being able to talk about the Battle of Stones River. This was such a significant battle that happened here in Middle Tennessee. Where can people learn more about the Battle of Stones River online and social media?
Yeah, we have a Facebook page that is currently, you know, and even on the day this is being aired, we'll have, you know, a special post for the anniversary, and that's Stones River NPS is where you find us. We also are on Instagram and Twitter as well with that same handle. And then our website, if you actually just Google Stones River National Battlefield, will be the first thing that comes up, but it's NPS.gov with a /STRI, and that's how you find us. And our website has, you know, you can kind of casually flip through it. You can look at our new virtual tour that we finally got, you know, done because we had the time to do it during all this COVID stuff. But you can also find resources there. People really want to drill down and get into, you know, some of the heart of the resources and stuff. They can, you know, you can kind of glance over the top of it or start clicking away deeper and deeper. And it really is up to you how far you want to go and how deep you want to go. So, we're continuing to work on that, you know, while COVID gives us essentially a break from, you know, the outdoor and in-person programming, we're going to keep, you know, putting that out there. So, and I'm sure there'll be a link to this podcast on our Facebook page as soon as I get it.
There you go. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We had a great time, and we look forward to, in the future, probably talking more in detail about you know, anything that has to do with this area. But we thank you for telling us the story.
Thank you, fellas. I appreciate it.
And that was Jim Lewis, the Chief of Interpretation, Education, and Cultural Resource Management at Stones River National Battlefield. And I think I speak for probably both of us when I say I never get tired of learning about the history of the Civil War here in Middle Tennessee.
Oh, I don't get tired of it at all. I didn't realize that the Battle of Stones River was one of the most pivotal battles in the United States during the Civil War. So I learned quite a bit about this battle and just the Civil War in general. And it's really interesting. The thing I think both of us can say is the history of the United States is so well connected. And if that these stories didn't happen, we wouldn't have the United States as we know it today.
I think that's very, very true. So we are thankful for Jim for hopping on the program and doing that interview with us. If you've gotten to this point in the program, thank you so much for listening. And if you are a Patreon subscriber, thank you so much. We appreciate it. If you are not, you get this National Story episode a day early. So we would encourage you to visit NashvilleDailyPodcast.com to learn more. You also get a limited edition Nashville Daily coffee mug along with your subscription to head. So head over there today and learn more about that. To learn more about Nashville, XPLR.Nash on Instagram, YouTube, and XPLR.life for some Nashville merchandise if you're not all shopped out already from Christmas and all the holiday stuff. But we appreciate you guys.
Civil War merchandise is coming soon.
It is. But thank you guys for listening. Regularly scheduled Nashville Daily Podcast coming to you on Monday with some great stuff there. Hope you have a great weekend.